I sat up straighter. Very likely there was a but in there somewhere, but the minister was at least sounding reasonable. Of course, some quid pro quo would be in order as well, since you've already decided to put the Spitz in Ship 3, and the remaining space is just about right for our enclave. And without our surplus, we'd be part of the have-nots. It seems to me that we would be a reasonable choice for the balance of the ship's allocation. The minister looked at me expectantly. I bristled at the implied request for favoritism, then had second thoughts. Everything he said was true, and while the Faith Enclave wasn't a shoe-in to be next in line, they weren't an unreasonable choice either, especially with any surplus gone. And rewarding such an overt display of cooperation would send the right message. I stared into space for a few milliseconds. Interesting. I would actually be displaying a negative bias by dismissing his proposal out of hand. Minister, that's a surprisingly reasonable proposal. I'll have to discuss it with my team, but it sounds like it'll fly. Minister Cranston managed not to look too smug. With a nod, he reached for the off switch. "One moment, Minister. There's a small matter that I need to discuss with you." I filled him in on the hack attempt, leaving out any details of why it failed. "Any thoughts on this?" He was silent for several seconds, an eternity to me. When he spoke, he sounded uncharacteristically embarrassed. "I'm assuming, Mr. Riker, that the geographical source of the attempt is the only reason that you are asking instead of accusing." He gave a small smile. "As it turns out, New Zealand makes sense. The fact is that our probe technology may not have been, entirely original faith research. Australia was working on the probe concept, and one of our agents may have, borrowed some ideas."
"Espionage? You stole their plans."
"Call it what you will. It's very likely that the Australian Federation has or had some very good insights into your original design, and New Zealand is where most of the survivors would have ended up once Brazil started dropping rocks on Australia."
He looked at me with his head cocked, the implication clear.
"Very interesting, and thank you for being frank about that, Minister Cranston."
We said our goodbyes, and I sent a quick IM to Charles and Homer. Charles's response came back within moments.
"I agree on the faith proposal. That also saves our relatives. I know you don't want to make that part of the equation, but I'm less worried about being impartial."
And from Homer.
"Agreed. And the Australian explanation sounds reasonable. Cranston very rarely sounds reasonable. I hope he didn't sprain something."
I chuckled at that. "Okay. Looked like we had a deal."
50. Bob, June 2166, Delta Eridani.
In retrospect, I guess we should have expected it. There had to be a reason why the Deltans had abandoned this side of the divide, despite the better locations and resources. And there was, in the form of gorilloids. The Deltan migration was large, noisy, and spread out. Like a traveling smorgasbord, they proved an irresistible attractant. The gorilloid raid struck early in the morning, after first light when the drone IR sensors had become useless. Of course, the gorilloids neither knew nor cared about that. They simply moved when they had enough light to see. The Deltans were half asleep, half organized, and totally unprepared. The number of attackers totally overwhelmed any defenses, and even took Marvin and me by surprise. They attacked on several fronts at once in classic pack-hunting style. They cut off individuals from the main group while keeping the defenders busy with feints. A dozen Deltans, females and juveniles, had already been grabbed. Fortunately, we had the busters on standby as a matter of policy. It took less than 10 seconds to bring them in. A dozen gorilloids disintegrated in claps of thunder. We had to select targets that weren't too close to Deltans, so this did nothing to save the abductees. That posed a separate problem. "Guppy, put a drone on each Deltan abductee. Stay with them no matter what."
"Aye."
The buster attack froze the gorilloids and rallied the Deltans. With the flint-tipped spears, the defenders had the upper hand in close-quarters fighting.
"There are too many. We just don't have enough busters." Marvin looked to me with panic on his face.
I turned to Guppy.
The busters at the auto factory
are on their way. However, transit time will be almost a day at maximum acceleration.
We had started with 25 busters. We'd used up half of them in the first rally, and almost 50 gorilloids remained. I found myself frozen for several milliseconds. Marvin snapped his fingers.
Let's not use them all destructively. Hit the gorilloids at the speed of a thrown rock. A 40-pound steel ball will still slow them down. Then the Deltans can finish the job.
Do it.
We began hitting the gorilloids at low speed. Gorilloids were amazingly tough. A strike from a buster at that speed would kill a human outright. But the gorilloids were only stunned for a moment. In several cases, I found myself bludgeoning the same gorilloids multiple times. We were still losing busters. A unit could handle up to a dozen strikes before something malfunctioned. I made a mental note that we would have to figure out a way to collect the busters for repair, and quickly. Guppy, start the auto factory on building more busters, top priority, and send a couple of transport drones to the migration location.
Aye.
Eventually, the Deltan's defense gained the upper hand. The females and juveniles had packed into a dense mass in the middle, and the gorilloids couldn't get close enough to break off any stragglers. The defenders moved in organized groups and covered each other's backs. We were down to 6 busters and had to be very careful about conserving them. Okay, Marvin, it's time to go after the abductees. Guppy, give us a rundown on locations and status. Guppy popped up a relief map of the area with the location of Deltan victims and a tool tip beside each. It didn't look good. Over half of them were already being eaten. We each took 2 busters and went after the gorilloid groups. We'd smack the gorilloids in the back of the head until they either gave up and ran away or the victim got loose during the distraction. In the end, we saved maybe a third of the abductees. I flew a drone over to Arnold. There are people who are injured and can't make their way back to the tribe. You'll need to organize retrieval parties. Arnold gazed at the drone for a few moments, then started pointing to individual Deltans and giving orders. I had to hand it to the Deltans. They were a decisive race. When action was required, there was no backtalk. In moments, they had organized rescue parties who jogged off following the drones. I expected all but one of the surviving abductees to pull through, although some of them would have permanent disabilities. I sighed and looked at Guppy. How many to-dos do I have concerning teaching the Deltans some basic medical procedures?
26.
That's what I thought. I was scared to ask how many total to-dos I had stacked up. Not for the first time. I considered building a couple dozen bobs and attacking the list until it was under control. And as usual, I couldn't think of any items on the auto factory list that I could bump to make room. I'm sick of this. Guppy, I want the buster count up to 50, then I want you to pull 1 printer group and set it to building more printers. It's time to bootstrap.
Printer group duplication is time and resource intensive, and will impact operations over and above the immediate loss of manufacturing output.
I know. Short-term pain, long-term gain. If we'd done this in the first place, we'd be breaking even now. It's time to get ahead of things. I turned to Marvin. I'm seriously considering constructing explosive armaments. His eyes went wide.
Wow, that's a hell of a concession. We hate explosives.
I know. Plus, there's a risk of blowing up the printer with each unit built. I'm thinking of building them the old-fashioned way. I'll build a chemistry lab, assign some roamers to it, and use industrial methods to build warheads.
You're talking about significant lead time.
Marvin shook his head, doubt written all over his face. Yeah, but I have a bad feeling that we're going to be facing gorilloids for a long time. Run the numbers and calculate what the average population density has to be in order for them to be able to gather that many gorilloids together in so short a time. I think this side of the pass is gorilloid central.
Marvin stared into space for a millisecond or so, then nodded. I see what you mean. This is going to be a war of extermination.
After coming all this way, you want us to stop here?
The elder's ears were sticking straight down in the Deltan equivalent of an incredulous stare. I looked around the tribal circle and saw the same expression on most of the faces. I sighed. The drone was not a great way to have a conversation. It might be impressive to a primitive people, but the lack of body language was really hampering me. I tried again. It's only temporary. I destroyed most of my busters. the translation program rendered that as flying rocks. In that attack, I need to build more. At least here, we've thinned out the gorilloids and put a scare into the surviving ones. Arnold, who was now a member of the circle, nodded in agreement.
It is true. The beasts will not attack again soon. They lost 3 for every person they took, and we got most of those back.
Sadly, although the gorilloids hadn't done well in terms of stealing a meal, they had managed to kill almost 20 Deltans during the attack. That was an unsupportable level of attrition. A few more attacks and we'd be back down below the numbers at the start of the migration.
How long?
The Elder wasn't conceding. He was asking for clarification. I wasn't anywhere near done here yet. 5 days. I have more busters on their way, and I want another set on hand before taking on more risk. After that, I'll be bringing in more as fast as I can make them. Arnold stepped in again.
This is not going to be over in a hand or two of days. For this many gorilloids to have shown up so fast, there must be many of them.
I spared a moment to be impressed by this observation. I looked at Marvin, whose eyebrows were climbing to his forehead. I guess that's a reminder, I said to him, that big doesn't mean stupid. This guy is sharp. I returned my attention to the drone. Correct. I'm running my flying rocks through the forests, counting up the gorilloids. Then we'll have a better idea of what we're up against, and maybe we can avoid the biggest concentrations.
Can you not just kill them before we get to them?
It was a reasonable question. I would be using up my busters killing gorilloids that might never bother us. Better to concentrate our energies on those who show up. I will, however, give more warning in the future. The elders nodded. They understood scarcity of resources. Orders were given and people started to set up a more long-term camp. Arnold organized hunting parties, and I went looking for Archimedes to talk about tent poles.
It seems like a lot of work for not much benefit.
Archimedes examined his first attempt at a tent. Really, it was barely a lean-to. Your blanket isn't big enough to supply much coverage. With a larger blanket, you could make it tall enough to walk in and out, and you'd have sides to keep the rain and wind out. Archimedes walked around it.
Hard to pack and carry. Hard to set up. It seems like something that would be more useful in a permanent camp.
Marvin laughed at the look on my face.
Take that, oh great sky god!
Shut up! I set aside the tent project and changed the subject to straightening spears. This was something that both Archimedes and Arnold were both enthusiastic about. They'd seen the difference that simply picking straighter spear shafts could make. The idea of taking almost any shaft and straightening it was a revelation to them. We talked for a while about how to steam the crooked piece of wood and how to build bending jigs. Arnold and Archimedes left to look for construction materials, the axe hanging casually across Arnold's shoulder. I rotated the drone to look over the camp. So many things to do. I might have forever, but these people? Not so much.
51. Bill. January 2174. Epsilon Eridani.
Message received from Milo.
I looked up, momentarily irritated by the interruption. I'd been going over growth projections for the mosses, lichens, and grasses that I was cultivating. I'd built one of Homer's farm donuts to grow as much base stock as I could manage before introducing it to the surface of Ragnarok. He went to 82 Eridani, right?
Correct.
So,
message contains a description of a very positive potential colonization destination. Message also contains a record of the destruction of the Heaven Vessel.
What? I filed my work, cleared my desk, and pulled up a message from the in-queue. I could hear Milo's enthusiasm as he described the early survey of the system, and his fear as he relayed the information about the approaching missiles. There was a differential backup attached, but I had a bad feeling. Guppy, any chance on that backup?
Negative. The transmitted backup was cut off before completion.
Damn.
There was a lot of information on this in the libraries. If I attempted to kludge something anyway, to forcibly restore him, basically, there was a very good chance that the result would be insane or simply non-viable. As sad as I was to lose one of us, I had no desire to see myself in that condition. Okay, Guppy. Archive the backup. Mark it in memoriam. We've got 4 version 3 Bobs being built right now, correct? At Guppy's nod, I continued. Start another 4 as soon as physically possible. Give all of them extra busters. We're going to extract payment for Milo.
Aye.
This Medeiros character was really turning into a thorn. First Epsilon Eridani, then Alpha Centauri, now this. Time to take out the trash.
52. Riker, January 2168, Sol. I popped into Homer's VR. Hey, number 3. Homer grinned back at me.
You know that'll never be as funny as number 2, right?
Meh, I shrugged. Now that you've gone all establishment, you need a nickname. I popped up the list he'd sent me earlier. You're really going for this ranch donut, aren't you?
Why not? We way over-engineered Farm 1 to the point of embarrassment, honestly. We've learned enough that I think we can give a half G at the rim without coming anywhere close to failure. And now that we've figured out atmosphere controls, he raised his eyebrows knowingly at me.
In fact, the first couple of months of Farm 1 had been a nightmare. Every aspect of the environment kept going into positive feedback loops. We'd ended up putting 4 full-time AMIs on the job until we were able to figure out how to dampen the resonances.
Okay, General Bull Moose, just remember the little people, okay?
Homer laughed, and I called up a coffee. Things were looking up.
The donuts, as we'd taken to calling them, looked like fat bicycle wheels. Carbon fiber cables ran from the hub to the rim, providing most of the structural support. 3 thicker spokes provided elevator access from rim to hub. The donut was oriented perpendicular to the sun, and mirrors between the rim and hub reflected sunlight into the interior through the transparent roof of the rim. Everything was designed as simply as possible to minimize construction time and material requirements. I sipped my coffee in silence for a few moments. What I'm really liking is that Vehement can't get at these things. Sabotage proof.
Unless they develop ground-to-space capability, Homer replied in an offhand tone.
I glanced at him, but I don't think he was suggesting it as a serious possibility. There had been more attacks on food supplies Earthside, and we'd been shifting supply schedules to compensate. The new farm would hopefully take the pressure off. Farm 1 was delivering raw kudzu on a regular basis, allocated by population and by need. I had been assured by Julia that no amount of inventive spicing could make kudzu anything other than, well, kudzu. Plus, it had digestive consequences similar to beans. Good time to be a replicant. Homer had come up with endless variations on the Beans, Beans song, some of which had caught on Earthside. The second space farm would be going into production in a week, and my calculations indicated that it would bring us into a comfortable food surplus situation for the next 3 years. After that, falling Earthside production would again become a significant issue. The third station, which was still about half finished, would be a mix of crops, both for dietary variety and nutritional health. Homer was talking about establishing ranching on the fourth one, cattle, pigs, and chickens. Sheep, if the New Zealanders didn't eat all the stock first. There was genetic material in the Svalbard vault, but we would have to build the artificial wombs if we wanted to use that. Homer had turned into an industrial tycoon. He was understandably proud that his idea had worked, and so well, and it had become an all-consuming pet project for him. I finished my coffee and stood up. Back to the salt mines, I guess. Try not to blow anything up, okay? Homer saluted me with one finger as I popped out.
53. Bob. June 2166. Delta Eridani. The Deltans were attacked again before we pulled up camp, but not by gorilloids. I had become so obsessed with the gorilloid Delton struggle that I'd forgotten that this planet had a full-on ecosystem, as diverse and rich as anything Earth had ever produced. And that included more than one apex predator. In this case, the attackers were something that filled the same niche as a leopard or other jungle cat, except that this species hunted in small packs. They took down a hunter who had stepped a few paces too far from the group. The rest of the Deltans jumped to his aid and laid into the predators with spears. It was over in moments. Fortunately for the intended victim, I guess, the leopard analogs, I was not going to call them leopardoids, didn't kill their prey instantly. Like many big cats, their strategy was to get a death grip and suffocate the victim. The bad news was that the hunter was left with some pretty significant wounds. As they helped him back to the camp, one of the other hunters joked that he'd be entitled to one of the carcasses for being such good bait. "I really like these people," I said into the air. Marvin turned to glance at me.
"Damn good thing, too. Otherwise you'd have to work up a fire and brimstone routine."
Yeah. Brings up a point. I'm going to hang around and help them for a generation or so, but I'd better let myself fade into legend after that. I really can't afford to let them become dependent on me.
Right. And that's probably when I'll take off.
Marvin pulled up a star chart of the space around Delta Eridani. Places to go, species to meet. In the silence that followed, I reflected again on how little I looked forward to Marvin leaving. We'd diverged, since he was created, into two distinct people, but we got along, which wasn't a sure thing. I smiled to myself as I remembered one of Bill's transmissions detailing some of the fireworks of Riker and Homer's early days. Wish I'd been there for that. It sounded like a great show. With the arrival of the latest batch of busters, we were sufficiently up to strength to be able to risk resuming the march. I announced this to the Circle of Elders, but was careful to phrase it as information rather than as an order. I didn't want to fall into the trap of putting myself in charge of their fates, and I certainly didn't want the political fallout among the Bobs from creating that kind of situation. The Elders discussed things, then announced we'd be leaving the next morning. Departure went without a hitch. The Deltans had benefited from a week or so of rest. Most of the wounded were now mobile enough to keep up, and they had built up their supplies during the stop. I had doubled the overnight guard and had every single available buster in the air, ready for so much as a butterfly to twitch. Maybe the gorilloids felt the bad karma because they were nowhere to be seen. The going was slower than the first half of the migration. The land was a little rougher and the forest verged on being jungle. We were on the south side of the mountain range, and the climate reflected the slightly more tropical latitude. On the minus side between that and the enforced stopover, we would arrive well behind estimates. On the plus side, it really didn't look like the approaching winter would be much of a concern on this side of the mountain pass. I decided to be philosophical about it. As the Deltans walked, I floated along beside Archimedes. He had recently become quite attached to one of the females from his cohort, whom I had named Diana. She was obviously afraid of me, but didn't want to look bad in front of Archimedes. She stuck as close to him as she could, while trying to stay as far from my drone as possible. It was a little comical, but I didn't give in to my more immature urges. At the moment, we were discussing medical knowledge and procedures. The Deltans were in the potion and poultice stage, and while I had no doubt that some of their concoctions had some medicinal value, I was pretty sure that some root wasn't going to fix a broken leg.
"Yes, I understand, Bob. You've brought enough new ideas that have worked. I'm willing to take your word for it."
Archimedes shrugged.
"But the medicine woman has been doing things her way all her life. I'm not going to go head to head with her."
"Okay, point taken. How about you introduce me to her, then?" Archimedes nodded, then turned to Diana, who was somehow managing to look even more alarmed.
"You don't have to come," she said.
"I want to,"
she answered.
"Maybe she'll kill him."
"Wow. Maybe I'd line up a buster or two for the meeting." We endured three more attacks before we arrived at the Flint site. None of them were as big as the first attack, and we only lost a couple of people overall. On the other hand,
Gorilloid losses were extensive, a fact that made me very happy.
We're going to hunt them out?
Marvin looked shocked. Hell yes. Take out gorilloids for miles around. I waved at the relief map. Thin them down to the point that the Deltans can handle them.
And what about when they repopulate? It'll just be the same thing all over again. You'd be better off to kill the ones that attack and leave the others alone. Eventually, you'll breed a type of gorilloid that doesn't like attacking Deltans.
I thought about that for a moment. You have a point.
Well, we'll see how bad it is when we get to the site. It may need some upfront thinning just so the Deltans have time to sit down and eat in peace.
I hear that. 54. Riker, October 2170, Sol. Final assembly. Two magical words that sent a thrill through me. Homer, Charles, Ralph, and I drifted a half kilometer from the two ships. We'd all agreed that it was pointless to be physically present when a video feed from a drone was every bit as good, but we'd done the agreeing while rushing to be here in time for the event. So much for logic. Even Colonel Butterworth had talked about taking one of the shuttles up to watch, but he'd eventually regained his senses. As the ships had approached completion, we deliberately adjusted construction resources to bring their status into sync. Both ships were now complete, except for the final connection of the drive rings to the hull.
Damn, dude. We've actually done it.
Homer's voice was filled with the sense of awe that we all shared. For someone who grew up in the 20th and 21st century, this was by far the largest single engineering project ever undertaken. I couldn't help thinking of the Utopia Planitia scenes in the Star Trek movies when a starship was being constructed. This had much of the same flavor. I looked over at the summary window. Every UN delegate was online streaming the video. The UN had had a rare rush of common sense to the head and decided not to make speeches. I suspected that the fact that every single one of them would want to make a speech had figured into that. It would have worked out to about 8 hours of speeches. Kill me. And finally, the construction AMI reported that all connections were successful. The two colony ships, officially Exodus 1 and Exodus 2, were complete. I was surprised to find myself tearing up. Okay, maybe not all that surprised.
So now what, Will?
Julia was surrounded by several members of her family in the video window. Conversations with the famous ancestor had become a regular thing at the Hendricks household. There were always people entering and exiting the video window. I didn't mind at all. The sight of my sister's descendants made me feel real, much more than the VR could. Knowing that a piece of me had lived on was satisfying on a level that I couldn't come up with words to describe. It might not be quite like being a parent or grandparent, but it would certainly do as a next best. I popped up an inset list. System tests, integration tests, stress tests, and finally a shakedown cruise. Stuff happens, of course, but it should be pretty routine.
And the third ship?
Naturally, Julia was interested in that one. She and her family would all be on Exodus 3 along with the Spitz group. I had wrung that promise from Cranston before agreeing to his proposal. There was no reason for him to renege. The 300 or so people who couldn't fit on the third ship would be the first onto the fourth, and were guaranteed established homes when they arrived in Omicron Squared Eridani. Cranston had asked for volunteers, and surprisingly, he'd gotten them. I guess some people are happy to skip the hard work part. Julia sighed and smiled at me.
Before you arrived, there was a general feeling that we might be the last generation of humanity. Some people were saying it was selfish to have more children. I'm glad it didn't turn out that way.
She hugged her son, Justin, one of the newest members of Clan Bob, sitting on her lap. Justin had no idea what was going on, but the pictures were pretty, and he loved his Uncle William. I made a face at him, and he laughed. Justin Hendricks, Space Cadet. 55. Bob, July 2166, Delta Eridani. The day finally arrived when we reached the area of the Flint site. The former camp was at the top of a rise that stuck up out of the general forest level. On Earth, a castle would have been built there.
From my earlier survey, I knew that it commanded a view of the forest for miles in every direction, right out to mountains and hills on the horizon. The site was rocky and bare, but had a depression at the base of a rock shelf that formed a natural, sheltered area. Several rock pools formed natural reservoirs filled by the frequent rains. A central mesa rose from the shelf like the conning tower of a submarine. It was, in fact, such a naturally ideal site that conversations kept coming around to why it had been abandoned.
"Don't know,"
was all we got from most of the elders. Moses commented that he only remembered his parents being very scared. He thought, and it seemed likely, that the place had been overrun by gorilloids. One of the other elders, I noticed, didn't seem comfortable with that explanation. I resolved to talk to him later. I directed the drones to do a quick survey to a mile in radius looking for gorilloids. The results were chilling. This appeared to be a gorilloid preserve or something. The damn things were everywhere, but why? With no Deltans to eat. This felt like a badly laid out D&D scenario. The answer wasn't long in coming. I hadn't really done much in the way of biological analysis or investigation since I'd discovered the Deltans, and I guess this was my comeuppance for that oversight. The gorilloids were omnivores. The vegetation on this side included a tree with nutritious seed pods, the gorilloids' primary staple. The pods were tough to get to and tough to open, which explained the size and strength of the animals. And if the biochemistry of Eden followed that of Earth, the pods would be incomplete protein sources. So what has lots of protein? Deltans, of course. That looked like the explanation. The seed pods were more than plentiful enough to supply a large population of gorilloids, but the beasts would be crazy attracted to protein sources. And I just marched a couple of hundred bundles of protein right into the middle of them. Great. But there was still something about the gorilloid population that didn't add up. Without warning, a couple of loud booms reverberated through the forest.
"Two gorilloids approached within proscribed distance and were neutralized."
"Thanks, Guppy. Good job." I didn't want any surprises, so I'd instructed Guppy to busterize any gorilla that strayed within 100 meters of the Deltans. The Deltans were quite used to the sonic booms now and only looked up to check for more gorilloids, but drone sensors showed gorilloids leaving the area in a hurry. "Arnold, we need to get into a defensible position." Arnold nodded to the drone, then turned and started yelling orders. Deltans moved with alacrity toward the bluff. Outriders on guard brandished the biggest and best spears. The Deltans settled in without difficulty. There were old fire pits, cleared off sleeping areas, and even piled up rocks usable for building small walls. Arnold set up sentries immediately and asked me about the distribution of local gorilloids. He didn't look like he liked my answer. Couldn't really blame him. The moment their luggage hit the ground, Archimedes and Moses headed off for an area that Moses pointed to. The Acme Axe and Spearhead Manufacturing Company, unincorporated, was about to be launched. I assigned a drone and a couple of busters to shadow them.
"Well, are we going to do a culling?"
Marvin's expression indicated pretty clearly what he thought of the idea.
"Nah, you're right. We need a long-term solution which involves gorilloids learning to avoid this area and teaching their young to avoid it as well. I'll keep the buster AMIs on sentry duty, and we'll just take out any gorilloid that comes too close. They'll eventually make the connection."
"And the tribe will learn to expect the protection of the Bob."
Marvin laughed, but I sensed an edge to his humor. I directed a raised eyebrow his way.
"Have a look, boss man," he said, and pulled up video output from one of the drones.
In a corner of the flint site, some Deltans had carefully arranged pieces of a buster and had placed small torches around them. My eyes widened. "That's
an altar." "Yep. All hail the Bob."
56. Bill. March 2167, Epsilon Eridani. The orbital schematic display laid it all out, and I didn't like the message. I looked over at Guppy. No help there. Admiral Akbar stared back at me, blank, fishy expression revealing nothing. "Can we still save the iceberg?"
probability greater than 50%. However, we may not be able to save the asteroid moving equipment.
I rubbed my forehead and tried not to swear.
Okay, Guppy, you take care of the course corrections. I'll set up a script for the drones for retrieval of the drive. Maybe we can cut some corners.
The iceberg coming up on Ragnarok was one of the biggest we'd found so far in the Kuiper Belt. This particular piece of ice had come in a little off course, and we were going to have to run the asteroid drive at maximum until the very last moment to get it into the proper trajectory. I didn't want to fumble it and have the berg sail off into the sun, or worse, impact the planet at speed. Guppy began applying course corrections with the changes registering on the schematic in real time. I watched the display absently while I weighed my options. If necessary, I was prepared to let the drive go down with the iceberg and just build a new one. For a smaller chunk of ice, I'd have just shrugged and let it sail on past the planet, but this baby was huge. I could lose every other incoming chunk for the next 6 months while I built a new drive and still come out ahead. But if I lost the drive, I'd have no control over the pieces following this one. If one came in dead center, I would have to watch it go splat. We were shepherding chunks of ice from the Kuiper Belt, spaced about a week apart. Garfield found them and sent them inwards using his asteroid moving drive, and I caught them at this end with mine. In another 10 years, we would have dropped enough ice on Ragnarok to connect its small seas into actual oceans. My long-term plan was to make the planet fit for humanity to colonize.
Coming up on alignment. 2 minutes to shutdown.
Thanks, Guppy. How much time will I have to get the drive off the berg?
650 seconds.
Wow, that was tight. I reviewed the script that I'd written for the drones. 12 minutes required for a clean retrieval. That was with some wiggle room, but still. There were 12 separate structures that had to be released from their anchors and flown off the interplanetary iceberg before it hit atmosphere. I had already written off the anchors. They would take far too long to extract. Hopefully they wouldn't do too much damage when they hit the ground. Garfield popped into my VR. How's it looking, Bill? He was watching the whole drama unfold and thankfully hadn't tried kibitzing. There wasn't anything he could do anyway from his location in the outer system. Twice the number of drones wouldn't have been enough to save all the equipment. I grinned at him. Just another day at the office. Nothing to see here. Move along.
Shut down. Begin retrieval.
I ordered the drones to start the retrieval process. From here on, it was up to the AMI artificial intelligences controlling the drones. All I could do was stay out of their way and not joggle their elbows. Either they'd save the equipment or Ragnarok would have some new craters. 650 seconds later, the ice asteroid hit atmosphere. We were out of time. If the berg was left to itself, it would skip through the upper atmosphere and sail on into the sunset, quite literally. Instead, I activated a number of explosive devices, and the iceberg fractured into a huge number of chunks, small enough to be melted before they made it through the layer of atmosphere. As the air dragged at them, they separated into diverging trajectories. They would all melt at high altitude and fall to the ground as rain over the next several days to weeks. Except for a bunch of anchors and 2 drive segments, which would suffer a slightly different fate. Nuts. I looked at Garfield and shrugged.
Well, I did warn you that could happen. Far be it for me to say I told you so.
No, of course not. I grimaced at the video. The next chunk of ice is due in a week. It's going to go splat, I'm afraid. Nothing we can do about that one. But if you can fly a couple of segments here ASAP, I can catch the ones after that.
And then build some spares?
Short term, yes. Longer term, Garfield, the whole anchoring thing bugs me. Slows down the installation, slows down the removal. Something was bound to go wrong eventually. I've been thinking of ways to do this without actual ground contact.
Garfield looked surprised. Seriously? Like, just position the segments in orbit around the ice chunk?
Mm-hmm. It would require 2 separate drive channels, but there's nothing wrong in principle with the idea. It would speed things up a lot. And I need a break from the Android project. Working the bugs out of that thing has become a game of whack-a-mole. Garfield laughed. Okay, old man. I'll pull a couple of segments and head them your way. Despite my comment to Garfield, As soon as I had parked the surviving drive segments, I opened up my Android project file. A video window opened up showing my current prototype located over on one of the orbiting labs. The Android was currently powered down and draped on the support rack. Bullwinkle was a quadruped design about the size of a moose and every bit as pretty. The external comms array on its head was strangely reminiscent of a famous pair of antlers. Probably not coincidence. Did I mention I'm not very mature? This was Bullwinkle version 5 kajillion or something. The basic concepts weren't that difficult. Artificial skeleton made from carbon fiber matrix, muscles made from memory plastics that would contract when a current was applied, and sensors to replicate the normal 5 senses. Package the whole thing up with a remote control system and a replicant, like yours truly, should be able to control it as if it was my own body. Well, that was the theory. Getting it working was an ongoing exercise in frustration. Bullwinkle was working fine, mechanically. The problem was with senses, reflexes, and communications. Wiring for touch, heat, and cold sensitivity required micro-precision akin to neurosurgery. Printers could only help so much, and the more of the contextual processing I built into Bullwinkle, the bigger the required local computer system. The more of it I designed to be handled remotely, the greater the required bandwidth. And the more that light-speed latency screwed things up. FTL communications would alleviate that, but I was still nowhere near making a scut small enough to fit into the moose. I ultimately wanted controlling the android to be an immersive experience. I wanted to feel myself running across the ground. I wanted to feel heat and cold and touch and the wind on my face. This was a far cry from controlling a drone or Buster, which was more like playing a video game. I was 90% there, but the last 10% was turning out to be a real PITA. With a sigh, I closed the folder and reopened the Asteroid Mover project. Back to work. 57. Mario, August 2169, Beta Hydri. Beta Hydri was 23.4 light-years from Sol. Rather than argue and compete with the other new Bobs for the closer candidate stars, I had decided to head for the far reaches. I loved to sail forbidden seas and all that Melvillish stuff. By the time everyone else worked their way out to this point, I hoped to have a working space station declaring Mario was here. And let's face it, I really didn't want to be around the other Bobs. It still amazed me how oblivious they were to the differences between each clone. It was creepy, not enough variation to make them separate people, but enough to give them different opinions. It was like seeing myself with brain damage. And yeah, Bob 1 had set the rule about Senior Bob being in charge, but I didn't see that holding for long. Original Bob had never been much of a follower. Well, whatever. I was here, they were there, and I liked it that way. Time to explore my domain. I dropped into the system, decelerating at a leisurely 2G. I could have come in a lot hotter, but on the off chance that there was a Medeiros here, I didn't want him to know what I had under my hood. He'd see the 2G, a fraction of the output of my heavily shielded reactor, and he'd get cocky, I hoped. I really wanted a chance to meet up and hand him another ass-whooping. I had a couple of busters with his name on them. No, really, there wasn't a lot to do between systems, so I'd had the roamers stencil his name on a couple of busters. So far, though, there didn't seem to be anything Brazilian in the neighborhood. Actually, there didn't seem to be much of anything. It was a large, well-filled-out system, but so far, I'd found no metal ore. Seriously, nothing! The star's spectral lines showed about two-thirds Sol's metallicity. Generally, the composition of the system would follow the composition of the parent star. Hands behind my back, I walked around the balcony of my treehouse, enjoying the view and the 1,000-meter drop to the forest floor. The forest had never existed except in literature, and even there it was an amalgam of a lot of different books. Mostly it was from Foster's Midworld, but I thinned things out so there were good lines of sight. I'd added lots of earth birds and deleted any large, hungry, dragony things.
I raised an eyebrow at Guppy. Got an opinion?
Above my pay grade.
I chuckled. The version 2 heavens had more core and memory space than Bob 1 had started out with. Guppy had a lot of room to expand in the standard design, and I'd given him even more. He was becoming a person in his own right. He was acerbic and flip, just this side of insolent. I loved it. And, of course, he wasn't a Bob clone. Okay, wise guy, got an analysis?
Those I have. Analysis? There's no metal.
Thank you, Captain Obvious. Any idea why?
No, but I note that all of the other elements are within expected ratios. Only metals are missing, and completely so.
And that was just not possible, not by any known theory of stellar or planetary formation. Guppy blinked once and turned to face me. I knew what was coming.
Someone else was here first.
Damn it! Medeiros. But shouldn't there still be an auto factory around? I cut off what I was about to say and thought for a few seconds. Something was fishy with that theory, beside the originator. Hold on. How much ore are we talking about? Based on how much we think this system should have, how long would it take Medeiros to turn it all into cute little Medeiri? Guppy thought for a moment, or calculated, or whatever.
1,732 years, give or take.
So we can rule that out. We've only come 20-odd light years, and he would have had to travel for the same amount of time. I was belaboring the obvious, and I knew it, but I'd always found that talking something out helped to work through it in my mind.
That does represent a flaw in the theory.
You think? I pointed to the inner planets on the system schematic. We may end up having to do some planetary mining. Let's go take a look at some of the rocky planets and see what's available.
Your wish is my command.
We took a few days to get to the fourth planet. I still didn't want to show all my cards in case someone was watching. GL-19-4 was a brown ball of mud with gray oceans and a thick, murky atmosphere. It looked like the result of a lot of volcanic activity, but I didn't see any immediate candidates in the way of rings or chains of volcanoes. I inserted myself into a polar orbit and began deep scans for, well, anything, really. Metal deposits, of course, but also volcanic activity, and anything else interesting. It was one of those good news, bad news situations. Good news? I found lots that was interesting. Bad news? No metals. None. Not within reach of anything in my arsenal, anyway. The planet had a magnetic field, so it obviously had a metallic core, but next to nothing in the crust. Oh, a patch here and a patch there, but not worth grubbing for.
Anomaly detected.
And this isn't anomalous enough already?
Double plus anomaly detected. Better?
Not loving it quite so much. For a fleeting moment, I thought of reinitializing Guppy. Only for a moment. Not that I needed to worry. One of our redesign items was to not allow Guppy to read our thoughts. That was just too creepy. He now required voice commands, however you define voice in a computer system that talks to itself. Okay, Guppy, what is it?
Accumulation of refined metal detected. An artifact.
Holy crap, I thought for a moment. Deploy 3 of our exploration drones. Send them down to the location of the anomaly. Have them carry a couple of roamers, too. Set one of the drones to spiral outward from the site, while the other 2 and the roamers investigate the site in detail.
Aye.
Guppy was all business now. This was serious. Had Medeiros crashed? Was it a probe from one of the other nations? The drones got there in record time. I think Guppy might have driven them a little aggressively and settled around the anomaly. One started to circle, gradually getting farther from the center, while the other 2 landed and spit out 20-centimeter roamers. The drones lifted off and started on close-up visual scans. One thing was obvious right away. This wasn't one of the probes. In fact, this wasn't from Earth at all. I couldn't describe exactly what about it screamed alien, but no human mind designed that. The best metaphor I could come up with was the alien ship in Prometheus. It just didn't make sense. I took a moment to savor the thought.
I had just found the first intelligent life outside of Earth. Well, okay, looking at the wreck, I might have just found the corpses of the first intelligent life, but still. It was obvious that this had been some kind of cargo carrier. The thing had crashed and split open. It had spilled out part of its contents, which seemed to consist of stacks and stacks of large metal ingots of various types. Each ingot was pure, all one element. Iron, titanium, copper, nickel, tons of the stuff. The carrier looked like it had only been a quarter full, though, unless some had been taken. It appeared we had found our metal thieves. Well, one of them. And thief was probably too strong a word, but still.
Anomaly.
Oh, for... what now?
See for yourself.
I picked up the video that Guppy offered to me, and my jaw dropped. The planet wasn't lifeless. Well, it was now, but it hadn't been at some point in the past. I was looking at a dead ecosystem. What you'd get if everything in the Amazon basin died all at once. It was dry, it was weathered, it was corroded. But it was trees and bushes and the occasional animal, and it went on forever. I sent down some biological analysis drones to do some necropsies and try to figure out what had happened here. That wasn't quite what they were designed for, but I had all the accumulated biological and medical knowledge from Earth and a very advanced piece of technology designed by, me. They poked and prodded and cut, and they got some suitable specimens. They had their orders, and the AMIs were entirely competent within the parameters they'd been assigned. I just had to stay out of the way and not joggle their mechanical elbows. The drones and roamers continued to examine the wreckage. Without being able to say why, I sent a couple of busters down to hover, menacingly. Things looked deader than dead, but I just had a spooky feeling. The report from the biological drones arrived on my desktop with a ding. I hurried over and opened the file. Oh, wow. Based on cellular damage, everything had been killed by something along the lines of a gamma ray burst. Basically a huge surge of radiation, more than enough to kill instantly. I knew that because not only had the animals been killed, but their intestinal flora, or the local equivalent, had been killed at the same time. There was no bloating, no rotting from the inside out. I had to make some assumptions using terrestrial analogies, but I was pretty confident that they would be close enough. I also noted how few carcasses we'd found. The specimens were all small, in odd, inconvenient places, or in poor condition, even for dead bodies. I was pretty sure that 99% of the fauna were unaccounted for. Without decomposition to provide a clue, I couldn't immediately tell how long ago this had happened. But wear and erosion on the carcasses and dead trees gave me some indications, as did an analysis of the number of forest fire tracks with no new growth. I estimated somewhere between 50 and 100 years ago. I sent the biological drones off to check another couple of points on the planet, especially a point as close to antipodal to this location as possible.
Emergency! Hostile activity!
What? What's happening?
One of the roamers is under attack.
Get the drones to do point-focused sonar pings. I want as much detail as you can get.
Done.
I dissolved my VR and cranked up to maximum frame rate. The video feed was real-time. It showed a window from the perspective of the roamer that was under attack, and another from the perspective of the second roamer. The first roamer seemed to be infested with mechanical ants. As I watched, the roamer was being eaten. Metal parts thinning and dissolving. Guppy, blow both roamers. Self-destructs now. Guppy didn't argue or question. The video feeds disappeared. And firewall our device comms. I doubt those things had time to finagle the encryption keys from the roamers, but why take chances? I turned to the SUDAR analysis, which was just assembling over the desk. To one side, Guppy had brought up the video record received from the roamers. I played back the video record first. The first roamer had opened a container or locker or something. It appeared to have activated the ants. Whether that was a defensive reaction or the ants just considered the roamer to be a resource to be acquired was anyone's guess. I doubted there was really much practical difference. Either way, the ants had started to disassemble the roamer. The SUDAR point scan showed that they were separating it by element. They didn't seem interested in the plastic and ceramic components. I didn't regret blowing up the roamers. I certainly couldn't have brought them back with the possibility of one of those ants coming along for the ride, and silly as it was, I'd read and seen enough science fiction in my day about advanced technologies taking over the communications system and getting into the computer. That's me we're talking about, after all. I can build more roamers. Where did the ants get their power from? I scanned the ship again and found that about half of the ants that had survived the roamer suicides were now still. I didn't know if they were dead or just on standby. I decided to scan at 5-second intervals to see what they were up to. Strangely, every time I scanned, more ants became active. The hell? I cut off the sudar scans for a full minute. When I did another scan, about a quarter of the ants were inactive. Oh, hell. I stopped scanning for 5 minutes, then did a quick scan with as low power as I could manage. Sure enough, most of the ants were inactive. Damn it, they're powered by the sudar beam. It was my scans that reactivated them. Well, that was a fine pickle. Any attempt to find out what they were doing would power them up. But that meant that the aliens had found some way to beam power through subspace and use it at the receiving end. I needed to examine those ants. I waited an hour, then sent a single 1-centimeter roamer in. No way an ant could piggyback undetected on a roamer only slightly bigger than itself. The roamer picked up a couple of ants and brought them out of the hulk. I had prepared a couple of small coffins for the ants, filled with a plastic goop. The roamer stuffed the ants into the goop, then added the hardener. I now had ants under glass, more or less. While they might be able to cut their way out of those, I hoped they couldn't do it before I completed a scan. I brought in my two drones in close, and they did the most intense and high-precision close-in scans of which they were capable. That would produce almost a molecular-level map of the ants. I watched in fascination as the ants both powered up and produced little cutters from their front appendages. Fortunately, they couldn't move, so all they did was drill a couple of holes in the plastic. Good to know. I detonated the roamer, can't be too careful, and retired to my treehouse to ruminate. I had completed my survey. There was no sign of a civilization on this planet, so the wreck was definitely alien. The aliens had come in, presumably killed all life with some kind of radiation weapon, mined the star system, collected the carcasses, then left. There were a lot of assumptions in there, but it fit the evidence. The scan of the ants had shown some interesting technology. I was already setting up simulations to test some of it. The scans of the Hulk didn't have any huge surprises. It appeared to be run by an AI or AMI of some kind. It had a fusion reactor. It had a surge drive. It had a sudar transmitter. However, the sudar unit seemed designed to transmit power to a tuned receiver, as well as using the sudar as radar. I'd taken detailed scans of that for further study. Maybe the aliens had come and rescued the crew and left the Hulk. I doubted that. There didn't really seem to be any accommodation for anything biological. It was probable that the ship was completely AI. Was this civilization biological at all? The fact that they'd collected all the carcasses hinted at an answer, and not one that I liked at all. I could only think of one reason to bother collecting all that protein. And was this a one-time event? Or were they raiding systems on an ongoing basis? If so, which way were they heading? I certainly wouldn't want this fate to befall the solar system, even if there weren't any humans left. The dolphins and chimps still deserved their chance. I felt a pang of disappointment as visions of meeting Vulcans or Asgardians evaporated. This was more like an alien scenario. As first contact situations went, this one sucked. Like it or not, I had to bring the other Bobs into this, which brought up another problem. At this distance, I couldn't send a message back to Bill. I would need the space station for a transmission, and I would need the raw materials in order to build one. The ore contained in the Hulk, even adding in the Hulk itself, wasn't enough. I would have to leave. 58. Riker, April 2171, Sol. The big day had arrived. The colony ships had been checked out end to end. They'd been inspected by the USE delegation, and they'd done a shakedown cruise to Jupiter and back. Now they were parked in low Earth orbit, waiting for their occupants.
Homer was doing a kind of war dance around my captain's chair, and I was forcibly reminded of my lack of rhythm. The VR upgrades from Bill meant that we Bobs could interact physically instead of just talking to each other through video windows. It had its downsides. I turned my attention back to the status vids, which showed people lining up for the ground to orbit shuttles. Each shuttle could handle 500 people, packed in like rush hour commuters. I remembered my early days as a